Today on The Takeaway for December 11th, Congress is one step closer to passing the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, giving the president a big policy win.
This is a day we've all been working to and working for on the path to yes.
Is this what bipartisanship feels like? Also on the show, Russian athletes are still doping and international sports says enough.
This was an industrial-scale cheating operation, the like of which we haven't seen.
Plus, climate change is making some U.S. neighborhoods unlivable.
Places that have been hit multiple times by multiple floods or hurricanes or other disasters, the result tends to be a level of resignation.
We explore which communities can be saved and which can't. But we start with USMCA.
This is a day we've all been working to and working for on the path to yes.
After 2 years of negotiations on the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, President Trump and the House of Representatives have come to an agreement.
We have successfully completed negotiations on a brand new deal to terminate and replace NAFTA.
The USMCA replaces the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement.
This trade agreement is much better than NAFTA. But in terms of our work here, it is infinitely better than what was initially proposed by the administration.
Repealing or renegotiating the 25-year-old agreement was one of President Trump's campaign promises, calling it a bad deal for U.S. companies. Now, securing an agreement for the USMCA is seen as a political win by all those who participated in its negotiations, including the Trump administration, House Democrats, and the governments of both Mexico and Canada.
The only thing we want to say today is mission accomplished. Thank you.
That's Mexico's Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard yesterday after the countries announced the trade deal in Mexico City. And while the deal is seen as a political win for all those involved, the actual content of the deal has more concessions the Democrats were able to win in order for it to pass, including questions on pharmaceuticals, workers' rights, and the environment. So to help us understand what the USMCA actually is and the rocky path to how we got here, we have two guests, Megan Casella, trade reporter for Politico. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jose Diaz Briseño, Washington correspondent for the newspaper Reforma. Jose, thanks for being with us on the show.
Thank you very much.
Megan, is this an actual example of, dare I say, bipartisanship?
In many ways, it is. This is something the Trump administration really wanted. As you just mentioned, President Trump campaigned on this in 2015 and 16 before he was in the White House. And at the same time, Democrats have spent the last year getting a lot of changes in this trade agreement that weren't originally there when they first signed one version of it a year ago. And so things like on pharmaceuticals, biologic drugs, labor standards, even the AFL-CIO, the nation's largest labor federation, endorsed this pact, which is really rare for that labor group. And it sort of signals just how much Democrats were able to win in this pact.
I want to talk a little bit more about the specifics there with labor unions and pharma giants in a second. Jose, President Trump and Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador were on opposite ends of the political spectrum for a while. How did they come together in this agreement?
I think specifically on the USMCA, the Mexican government was really urgently in the need of an economic political win. The Mexican economy was growing at 0% this year, and on the Mexican end, they see this as something that could anchor investment, at least in the short term and medium term. And it's unsurprisingly also because President Trump and President López Obrador had gotten along very well by containing also the migration flows with an accord earlier in the year. So it's surprising that there's some collaboration, but not at all given all the what's stake in the North American relationship.
And Jose, remind us again how linked Mexico and the U.S. economy are and how NAFTA played into that.
Yes, Mexico is currently the U.S. largest trading partner. The Mexican market is the main destination for exports like corn, rice, and things like beer and autos are assembled together. This is certainly something that people not necessarily know. People continue to think that China is the main trading partner of the U.S., but this year that changed. And this speaks about how relevant was the deal reached yesterday.
Megan, we talk a lot about, in this deal, we talk a lot about Mexico, but we often forget to talk about our neighbors to the north, Canada. What did they walk away from, or walk away with, I should say, from this deal?
Yeah, we don't talk as much about Canada because they were more agreeable to the terms that Democrats were demanding, and they were always along for the ride and always approving the changes that were going along. They gave up a little bit of access to their dairy market to American farmers. That was a big win for U.S. farmers, who otherwise the terms of the deal remained largely the same from the original NAFTA beyond that. And they also, they were pleased to see these higher standards for workers, higher environmental standards, and things like that. And so, even though we focus on the U.S. and Mexico in terms of the negotiations, Canada was at the table. They emphasize always calling in, if not there in person, to make this a three-way agreement.
And what role, Megan, did you mentioned labor unions at the top? Did they play in the negotiations? Because it's pretty rare for them to be involved in this, isn't it?
It's pretty rare for them to be so supportive, but they have played a really big role in terms of swaying Democrats' views on these PACs. And so once House Democrats won the majority last November, it became clear there were going to need to be some changes to this deal. And they were really sort of deferring in many ways to labor unions and wanting to make sure that they were on board. Getting support, or even which what we thought was more likely was getting neutrality from labor unions, would have given a lot of more progressive Democrats and labor-friendly Democrats some political cover to vote for the deal because it looked like labor unions were on board. And so we know that Richard Trumka is the president of that group I mentioned, the AFL-CIO. He was closely involved in these negotiations over this past weekend when they were making the sort of final checks and final rounds of negotiations. It was Nancy Pelosi, it was Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative, and it was Richard Trumka who were really most closely involved in those final talks because, they were sort of the three most important players at that point.
Jose, Mexico is experiencing the beginnings of a recession, we think. Is this actually a fair deal for Mexico, given that their economy is maybe not the strongest right now?
Well, the good news for Mexico is that basically anchors the access to the North American market, and Mexico remains within the North American sphere. Remember, President Trump, during his campaign back in 2015 and 16, he basically campaigned on terminating NAFTA, and there were worries about whether Mexico would continue to be part of this trading bloc. So in that sense, it's the first victory that economically Mexico got. Second, old analysts and international groups like the International Monetary Fund had basically underlined that uncertainty was one of the key aspects that was detaining, that was keeping the Mexican economy from growing. So if you saw yesterday's announcement at the National Palace in Mexico City, the Mexican finance minister was at the head table, basically just underlining how relevant this is for the economy. Now, in terms of labor, we must say that the Mexican private sector was not as happy with the deal, but as long as it maintained the access it had to the U.S. market, they accepted the most of the stuff. I must say that the labor conditions that were stipulated, we don't know the fine print of them at this moment. There are many interpretations regarding them, but it certainly opens the door for the U.S. to supervise free elections within unions in Mexico and also collective bargaining.
And Jose, to that point, yeah, there are politicians here in the United States like Bernie Sanders who argue that deals like NAFTA and potentially the USMCA allow businesses to shift operations to countries where labor costs are lower. And I would include in that potentially Mexico. Are there any aspects of the deal that seek to protect the interests of workers on both sides of the border?
This certainly is an agreement that is much more superior in terms of labor enforcement. Remember in 1993, when the first NAFTA was signed, labor and environmental standards were out as annexes to the deal. And now both are central part of the text of the USMCA, which makes them subject to dispute settlement mechanisms that were not there back in 1993. Now, it's relevant that this pact basically forced Mexico to finally pass justice labor reform, which was delayed by years. So certainly this deal has pushed much better protections for workers. Let's see how much can Mexico implement, and that's a question that many Democrats had in their minds.
Megan, at the top of the show, you also mentioned that the pharmaceutical industry was a player in this trade agreement. Tell us what their role was.
Definitely. So they were really supportive of the USMCA that was signed a year ago because it included some protections for a new class of drugs, a very lucrative new class of drugs called biologic drugs. And so the first version of the USMCA included 10 years of protection for those drugs. And so they were very pleased. They were big supporters that signed on. They were swaying lawmakers to support the deal from the very beginning. And then we found out just a week or so ago, and what's the latest version that Democrats have negotiated, those protections are stripped out entirely. So that's a big loss for the big pharmaceutical industry. And Democrats say it's a big win for them. Opponents of those provisions and those protections say that it makes it easier for drug manufacturers to keep prices high. And so Democrats wanted that out of the agreement. Something we've learned just looking back at how the negotiations went was that agreement was actually made over the summer. It was one of the first concessions that Democrats were able to win. And then it was kept secret until just the past week or so, because they did not want the big pharmaceutical industry to start lobbying and putting a lot of money into swaying lawmakers against this pact if those protections were not included.
Megan, we said also that this is something that's been 2 years in the making in terms of negotiations. And it comes at a time when I sort of asked you at the top, is this, you know, sort of tongue in cheek, is this an example of true bipartisanship? Mainly because when I think many Americans turn on the television or the radio these days, they see a very divided House and Congress. So how is it that these two political bodies were able to come together despite the very public displays of partisanship happening?
I think it's a couple of things. I think one, with the impeachment investigations going on, the timing was striking yesterday to see this deal rolled out on the same day, just an hour after the House unveiled articles of impeachment. That was striking to see. And we do know that impeachment sort of acted as a catalyst to try to get a lot of rank and file moderate Democrats to really start to ramp up their calls to get a vote. They did not want to go back home over the holidays and have to say, we're moving forward with impeachment and we have very few legislative accomplishments to show you. So we do know that it acted as a catalyst in that way. But I don't think that's the only reason this finally came together. We've seen over the past 2.5 years that things really only finally came together when they were right up against a deadline. So the first deal itself was only signed the day before Mexico's former president, Enrique Peña Nieto, left office. And that was sort of a deadline to get the three countries together. And so we've seen that over and over again. So I think just the looming deadline of wanting a vote by the end of the year before it got lost in next year's presidential election, I think that helped things sort of come together as well.
We got about 30 seconds left, Megan. If the House passes the bill, what other hurdles does it need to sign? Does it need to pass in order to clear?
It's got to go through the Senate, and we do think we'll see a little bit of pushback from some senators, even Republicans, who think it monitors trade and sort of restricts it more than it allows free trade. But we do expect it to get through that body, and then it'll get to the president's desk probably early next year.
Megan Casella is a trade reporter for Politico, and Jose Diaz Briceño is a Washington correspondent for the Mexican newspaper Reforma. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Water swallowing streets. Overnight, power lines sparking. Many who stayed behind, like Zach Zilkakis, now in the dark.
We're not sure what's out there. We're not sure what we're going to see when we open the door.
It's been more than 2 years since Hurricane Irma slammed into the Florida Keys and flooded the streets with debris and water. While some residents moved away from the island chain after Irma, the majority decided to stay. And for those that did, life in the Keys hasn't gotten much easier. Rebuilding efforts are still underway, and in some neighborhoods, street flooding has become an everyday occurrence, especially during this fall's unusually high tides. Now, the Monroe County government says that some of those roads might not be worth saving from rising sea levels. Last Wednesday, officials in the county released the results of a years-long look into how much and how high the island's roughly 300 miles of roads had to be elevated to keep them dry from sea level rise, and also how much it would cost. Christopher Flavelle is a reporter covering climate adaptation for the New York Times, And he told us that the costs to raise those roads are much higher than the government initially thought.
They estimated somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion to elevate all of the county's roads sufficiently high to protect it for a few decades. What they found was the actual cost is probably more like two or three times that. The problem with that difference is not only is it a lot of money in raw terms, but there are neighborhoods where there just isn't enough people, enough homes, enough property value to justify that expense.
You know, Christopher, the takeaway was down in Miami a couple summers ago where they are trying to raise some of the streets there and really grapple with potential future flooding. The Florida Keys feels much more vulnerable to the future that we're looking at when it comes to flooding and hurricanes, correct?
One way of looking at the threat brought by climate change to coastal areas is you've got different kinds of threats in terms of the pace of sea level rise and the exposure to hurricanes, but you also have different levels of value. And that term, that's a really loaded term. What constitutes a valuable neighborhood? Why is one place more valuable than another? But in naked economics terms, places like Miami constitute a huge amount of the state's GDP, lots of residents, lots of property taxes. Places like the Keys typically don't have that attribute. They're sparsely populated. They cost a lot of money to maintain. They don't have many residents to support that. And so the problem the Keys face is much more acute in that sense than Miami or other coastal cities because they just have to struggle to find the money to protect themselves and then to justify that kind of expense. And that's exactly where the Keys is right now.
What are the residents feeling about this?
It's a tough question. I went down expecting to find some degree of outrage, and I did. There were certainly residents saying, hey, I pay taxes. Why shouldn't my government do everything it possibly can to protect my home, and in that case, protect the road going to my home? But it was more subtle than that. There was also, I think, a pronounced element of, call it realism, people who said, I know that this part of the Keys will go underwater, just a question of how long it takes. And maybe it doesn't make sense to spend really incredible amounts of money just to elevate this one road. Maybe I could move.
Are the residents down in the Keys really willing to move?
We're not going to know until there's an actual plan on the table and somebody at the county or at the state draws a map and said, these places we can't protect. One thing I found in my reporting that I think it bears out everywhere you go is you see that places that have been hit multiple times by multiple floods or hurricanes or other disasters, the result tends to be a level of resignation. Whereas a part of the world that's been hit just once, they'll tend to say, I don't care what it takes, build this back.
So this raises a lot of questions about which places are worth saving or investing in. How do you expect that elected officials are going to make those calls?
If one were to describe not how this ought to work, but how it does work, I think it's probably fair to say at a high level, the places that get the most money are the ones that have either the best representation in Congress or know how to work the system, have sort of the local officials that are familiar with the way these grant dollars flow. So whatever ideal metric might be found for fairness, I don't think there's much argument that we're there right now. Everyone I've talked to for my job says whether it's FEMA dollars or HUD dollars or almost any federal state program, they aren't really being allocated based on any notion of what makes sense. Just who has the greatest need, who makes the biggest fuss, and who gets hit the hardest. What places like the Keys are starting to ask is there a more fair way to do this? Because we know the costs will grow. And that's really what's driving all of this. You're not going to have endless willingness by federal taxpayers to keep on funding that level of reconstruction everywhere around the country as the tab grows because climate risk increases. So at some point, you'll get a Congress saying, even though Area X was just destroyed by a hurricane or a flood, we don't want to keep on funding this. And that's when it gets really hard. So in a sense, the Florida Keys is trying to get ahead of that and say, before the money runs out, what do we want to do for a plan? Is there a plan that maybe most residents can get behind? And that's what makes this experiment so important.
How far away are they from getting a plan? What's next for the residents of the Florida Keys?
When I was down there, officials said that they hope in 1 year to have a plan that covers the entire network of roads, showing how much they have to be elevated and at what cost. That will then, in theory, give them all the hard data they need. It won't give them the political answers. Presumably, at that point, they'll have to go to residents and say, okay, here's how we propose approaching this, given the data that we have. What do you, the voters, think? This could all end up terribly, right? You could certainly imagine a world where residents say, I don't care what your numbers say. If my road's underwater, you better raise it. It's a test of the numbers, but probably more importantly, it's a test of the ability of a community to say, can we accept a system deciding which places to save, even if that means the answer might not be my house?
Do we expect what unfolds in the Florida Keys to perhaps become a model for being a little bit more realistic and pragmatic about how these decisions are made?
Every coastal county will have to at least acknowledge what the Keys is doing and say, hey, if they're taking a methodological approach and they're being systematic and thoughtful, if we're not going to do that, why aren't we doing that? Why are we just throwing money at the places that have the most need in the moment? But my guess is officials will look at the Keys not just as sort of a system to look at, but also to see what the result is, right? I imagine they want to see, can you get community buy-in with this? And can you use the transparency they're going for to achieve some degree of realistic resignation, which is probably the best you can hope for? No one's going to be happy with these outcomes. But I think the big question is, can you get to a point where they seem fair in the eyes of people who are losing their neighborhoods, their homes, their culture because of these decisions? That is a really high bar, but I think that's the goal.
Christopher Flavelle is a reporter covering climate adaptation for the New York Times. Christopher, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
With the threat of climate change looming, more and more storms may be forcing local communities to respond. But here in New York, we've already seen the results of local efforts to mitigate the impact of storms brought about by climate change. Back in 2012, Hurricane Sandy struck the U.S. Northeast, leaving an estimated $70 billion worth of damages. More than 147 people died, and many of the mostly working-class communities on the New York City coastline were some of the most affected by the storm. In response, the New York City government created the Build It Back program. But its results were less than ideal, showing many around the country what not to do when attempting to mitigate the effects of storms. Joining us to discuss the Build It Back program is Amanda Farinacci, Staten Island reporter for Spectrum News, New York One. Amanda, I've followed your work for so long, and I'm really excited to have you with us here in studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Hurricane Sandy sweeps through New York in 2012, does a lot of damage, particularly in these coastal areas. New York City then decided to create something called the Build It Back program. What is Build It Back?
So Build It Back is a federally funded program. It began under the Bloomberg administration, and it was basically a plan that derived out of, let's say, the Mayor Bloomberg started with a rapid repair program, which was a basic program that was meant to use federal dollars to get people back in their homes. It assisted them with things like installing boilers and getting your heat and just sort of doing the necessary baseline repairs to get people back into their homes. After that, in early 2013, Bloomberg announced, we realized people want to stay in their homes. How can we do that? So it became a program that was basically designed to use the eligible funds that were being provided through the federal government to get people to stay back in their homes. You could either have your home rebuilt, elevated, repaired, so in some cases knocked down and then replaced.
We're seeing a lot of this happen across the country, right? Whether it's fires or hurricanes that are forcing people out of their homes, out of their communities. There's a big question, I think, for me, which is who should be able to stay in their communities, right? And how does the federal government and the state government and the city government access or allocate resources to making that happen? We talked a little bit about this, but the Build It Back program was meant to do repairs, and then it was really about keeping people in their homes. What cost are we talking about, Amanda?
The money came from the feds through community block development grants, CDBG money, and it was basically, those are just like resiliency funds, for lack of a better way to explain it. It was funded at first $1.7 billion. The program came up short, I think right around the sixth anniversary, announced a $500 million shortfall. So we're looking at $2.2 billion.
Taxpayer dollars.
Okay. Yes. And so I think it becomes really sort of a question of, you know, a financial picture, because you can make a strong case that, say, people need to live in their neighborhoods. They are entitled. Certainly in New York City, there's a shortage of affordable housing, right, and wanting to keep people where they can afford to live. But it really does beg the question of at what cost? because that's a lot of money. The average home, the city will tell you at one point, to rebuild the home was about $640,000, an average. It was even more money to rebuild or to elevate and repair. These are astonishing numbers given, you know, the size of the homes, the quality they were in, the work performed. I think if you speak to some people who live in some of these constructed homes, they would tell you certainly that the repair work that they received is not worth $700,000.
And what we keep hearing from a lot of these areas, not just specific to New York, is that it's going to get worse, particularly on the coast, particularly where Hurricane Sandy hit a lot of these homes. So once this investment has been made by the city into rebuilding or elevating these homes, aren't those homes still at risk?
The city would say that the homes they've built are fortified beyond measure. And certainly one would hope that that's true, given, you know, the amount of money they spent on each one. I know on Staten Island and certainly out in the Rockaways and in sections of Queens, there is some work that's being done in tandem on Staten Island. They're in the process of making plans for a seawall to sort of help mitigate and slow down the waters. It seems like there should be two or, you know, a couple things happening at once. You create resilient, strong homes, but you need the barriers. You need the natural barriers. Out on the South Shore, there is an oyster bed that's being installed to slow down the speed of the waves. There's different things that are happening, certain talks of levees and things out in the Rockaways as well. I think it needs to be a big picture conversation. I'm not exactly sure that the housing piece is paramount. I think people in those neighborhoods would say it is absolutely the most important. But I do believe that there are certain neighborhoods where people just shouldn't live anymore.
Who's really benefiting from these programs?
These are people who, as I said, have been living in their neighborhoods for dozens of years, their families, because they are affordable. Certainly a home, the average median price of a home in many of the neighborhoods is only between $200,000 and $300,000. So these are people who oftentimes are older, have existing health conditions, have Medicaid, Medicare, pre-existing benefits that they get from the government. And, you know, they went into the Build It Back program because they didn't have the means to do it themselves, right? There was significant damage to a lot of zip codes in certain areas of the Rockaways, as well as the South Shore of Staten Island, that these are neighborhoods that have high economic incomes, people who are making money. Those people opted out of the program and did their own quote-unquote resiliency measures because they didn't want to be involved with the government programs and the bureaucracy and everything else. It was intended, I think, rightly to help those people who couldn't help themselves, but it's just the cost of it really begged the question of whether that's the right thing to do in the way they did it.
Where are we today, 7 years later?
So I think there were some 8,300 homes that were applicants through the program. I think all but 62 homes are still under construction. The de Blasio administration has really distanced itself from the program. They have gotten such criticism about the length of delay, the cost overruns, the unhappiness that people have about the bureaucracy and the quality of work. Mayor de Blasio the administration likes to say, oh, well, we inherited this problem from the Bloomberg administration, but it's worth pointing out that the Bloomberg administration only had the program for 6 months. We're now 7 years in. So, you know, the first time I reported on this story, we were talking about a home, the first home that was elevated on Staten Island. The value of the home is some $350,000. The price tag that the city spent was $786,000. The woman still to this day has issues in her home that she needs to continue to go back and say, can you help? Can you help? Can you help fix? So when we spoke to Amy Peterson, who's the head of the program, and said, like, once you realize that you have one home that has gone so far off the rails, why not press pause and say, let's see if we can do this a better way? But I think the sense was a little bit of stubbornness that we're going to try to keep people in their communities. I think that was the right thing. But I think they needed to press pause a long time ago, because what happened then is that it just kept going and it just kept getting worse.
There are probably other programs that are going to be modeled around this, you know, in areas that are impacted. What do you see are the best practices for balancing that issue between people wanting to stay in their communities and the realities of climate change and the taxpayer dollars that are going to go into funding a lot of these programs? You know, at what point do you have to? I mean, that's a tough issue. That's what we're kind of trying to unpack here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that the city did right is listen to people who said they wanted to stay, right? I'll give them that. I think they had very good intentions. I mean, short of that, I'm not really sure that there's anything. I don't think New York City should be the leader on this at all. I think that this is a missed opportunity. If there ever was a missed opportunity, this is perhaps the biggest one, because so often what happens in New York, sets the stage nationally. I think in this case, people should look at New York and say, that's what we should not do. That's what we should not do.
Amanda Farinacci is the Staten Island reporter for Spectrum News, New York One. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
On Monday, the World Anti-Doping Agency barred Russia from competing in international competitions for 4 years, including the 2020 Summer Olympic Games in Tokyo and the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics. It's the latest and most severe punishment in a years-long scandal that began in 2016 when revelations came out about a state-run doping program that implicated dozens of Russian athletes in the 2014 Winter Olympics. Russia is appealing the decision. Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev, while admitting that doping is a problem in Russia, dismissed the penalty as, quote, anti-Russian hysteria. But the ban has several loopholes built in, and some former Olympians and members of the anti-doping agency argue that it does not go far enough to deter the Russians from future cheating. Joining me now is Tariq Panja, who covers international sports for The New York Times. Tariq, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
So what exactly are the details of the ban when it comes to participating for Russian athletes?
The headline figure is strong. It's Russia has been banned from international sport for 4 years. What that means is Russia as a nation, Russia as a team, is banned from the major championships. So you mentioned the Olympics. Then you would have something like, say, the Soccer World Cup in Qatar in 2022. However, the loophole that some athletes are uncomfortable with is there is a lot of scope here for Russian athletes to actually be present. These are athletes who are not implicated in the doping scheme.
Tariq, how do we know who's implicated? Is there drug testing happening at the event itself? Is there a rigorous form of finding out who and who isn't implicated in this?
According to the World Anti-Doping Agency, they had a whistleblower database that was leaked to them in 2017. And that featured thousands of Russian athletes, and they're from 2011 to 2015, their blood profiles. And in that group, they identified about 200 or so suspicious profiles. And because Russia have manipulated this data, they say 145 of these cases they cannot probably resolve because the data is so badly damaged. Anyone on that database cannot now appear in future sporting events, they say. Of those, about a third are still active. However, there's been so much disinformation from the Russian side. You know, this saga has dragged on really since 2014, to be honest with you, which was when a German documentary first aired these allegations. Knowing who is and who isn't clean is going to be really tough.
Remind us again the scope of the quote-unquote doping scandal with Russian athletes. What exactly was Russia doing with or to its athletes to get to this point?
This was an industrial-scale cheating operation, the like of which we haven't seen in terms of sophistication. We had similar schemes in the 80s with the, you know, former East German athletes, for example, where the state was heavily involved. But here in modern times, Russia, at least between 2011 and 2015, was allowing and participating in a program to provide performance-enhancing drugs to scores of athletes across a range of sports and hiding their profiles, essentially disappearing positive tests. That program reached its peak at the Sochi Winter Olympics. This was a big statement of intent, both from a hosting point of view, but also from a performance point of view. Russia swept the board at those games, but it then turned out that Russia every night launched these clandestine operations on the drug testing laboratory at those games. These guys would sneak in and would replace dirty urine samples with clean samples under the cloak of darkness.
Tariq, you said, again, this goes beyond the Olympics. And I'm wondering, how does this affect Russian athletes? Does it complicate their ability to train and get ready for certain sports if they're assuming that they may not be able to play?
Absolutely. This raises uncertainty for hundreds of Russian athletes because this ban is across all signatories to the World Anti-Doping Agency Code, and that really involves all of the major sports. In fact, the process in which they're going to weed out which athletes are eliminated and which are allowed to perform, that hasn't been concluded yet. Those talks need to happen. But one place we can look is track and field. Track and field's governing body has barred Russia unilaterally since 2015 for this doping program. It's the only global sport or organization that really has held the line, has been so angered by what Russia has done.
Why aren't other sports as rigorous?
You need to look at the architecture of global sports and where Russia as a state fits into this. Russia, for example, sponsors a lot of international federations. Russia hosts a lot of their events. Russia has influential members on their boards. So a lot of this is tied in a way to Russian personal relationships and Russian financial relationships. So to be honest with you, what we can describe this as is sort of sport politics writ large.
You mentioned sports politics, but I really want to tie this to politics here. We read at the top a quote from Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev calling these penalties, quote, anti-Russian hysteria. Is he referring to what's happening here in the United States and our political backdrop of Russia? What's he talking about there?
And it's not just what's happening in the United States. Russia has been implicated across the board for a number of years for example, in the Brexit vote. Disinformation campaigns, etc., Facebook ads, funding parties, etc. And this kind of feeds into it. And Russia has always claimed that it has never done what it's been accused of doing, yet the evidence is mounting up. This is all part of this sense of this disinformation campaign. And also at home, this is important. In Russian TV, there's been, especially on these Kremlin TV channels, they've kind of stoked public anger by saying this is another invention by the West, invention by the Europeans to eliminate Russia from sports because they don't want to compete against a strong rival. They've also tried to fabricate this whole scheme as limited to the whistleblower, Grigory Rodchenkov, and a small group of people. You know, they've created sowed confusion in Russia and outside of Russia and tried to sort of create this fervor and patriotism that it's Russia against the world. And this is just another example of it.
Well, and to that point, I mean, we've seen historically that there have been countries that have used international sporting events to sort of boost their international image, despite what's happening politically. We look at the 1936 Summer Olympics in Nazi Germany, or General Augusto Pinochet holding a World Cup match in Chile in the 1970s. Are countries still using sports as a form of boosting their reputations around the world, despite their questionable, at best, political practices at home?
Absolutely. And I'd say hugely so, perhaps even more so than ever before. The next Winter Olympics is going to be in Beijing, 2022. China used the 2008 Summer Olympics as a huge coming out party for the state there. We have the Qatar 2022 World Cup in the Middle East. It's hard to look beyond any of these events as anything more than political. And it goes as far as winning medals, as Russia have tried to do by cheating the Sochi World Cup. And that the issue you have here are sporting bodies who are coming under pressure from, I dare say, more democratic nations, where the public are getting frustrated at the amount of public money being spent to host sporting events like the Olympics.
Tariq Panja is an international sports reporter for the New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.